Oscars.
Welcome to No Prize from God, Episode 6. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey. No Prize from God is a series of conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. My guest today is Satir Wongraven, one half of black metal legends, Satyricon. Satir is the vocalist, guitarist, keyboard player, and bass player of Satyricon in the studio, partnered with his longtime collaborator Frost, who is one of the best drummers in metal, without question. Satyricon was formed in Oslo in the early 90s, a crucial, integral, and definitive part of the Norwegian black metal scene, coming up around the same time as their friends in bands like Emperor, Enslaved, and Dark Throne. Satyricon have released essential black metal records like 1994's The Shadow Throne, in 1996's Nemesis Divina. Like the best and brightest of their contemporaries, Satyricon has worked as both a band that defines the black metal genre while transcending its boundaries. September 22nd, 2017 will see the release of the band's 9th studio album, Deep Calleth Upon Deep. In the far stone, when the moon rises and the shadows fall, Satyr's contributions to the black metal scene and subculture stretch even beyond the music of Satyricon. As co-founder of the record label Moonfog Productions, which has been around since 1992, he's released records from Dark Throne, Gehenna, Storm, Thorns, his project Wongraven, as well as a single track from the short-lived black metal supergroup Ibon. Darren from System of a Down is an avowed Satyricon fan, even helping them to temporarily team up with a major label here in North America. To the uninitiated, black metal is best known for the sensationalized headlines of the early 90s, where groups of teenagers, many of them musicians, and kids otherwise involved in the scene in Norway, were arrested for church burnings, and in some cases even murder. But what those headlines neglect is the artistry, passion, hunger, and yearning for some type of connection with tribal, ancestral, shamanistic, neo-pagan, you know, something beyond the consumerism or the whatever it is that causes disaffected youth to search for some type of deeper meaning across a variety of cultures, to reject kind of what's being fed to them by the societal powers that be, or parental pressure or peer groups. You know, in this case, these were kids who, you know, all around Europe and America and other places in the world who, you know, desecrating graves and doing obnoxious stuff and, you know, putting on corpse paint. But at the end of the day, the vast majority of them were metal fans and music fans, and they were really hitting on something complex and in many forms, if we're honest with ourselves, universal. Many of the young men and women who were part of that early black metal scene grew to become accomplished musicians in various permutations. Many of them are parents. Norway as a country in 2017 seems to even embrace its reputation as an epicenter for black metal and its contributions to music and youth culture. I found Satyr to be among the many thoughtful individuals to have been produced by that scene. In its oftentimes theatrical and sometimes grotesque rejection of Christianity and the world's major faiths in general, black metal often strikes at the heart of the disaffection and the too oftentimes oppression inherent in different strains of the church and its surrounding doctrine. Whatever your viewpoint about black metal and the various things that it has and has not stood for over the years, there's no denying the creativity and intelligence of a guy like Satyr Wongraven, who, by the way, also has his own line of wines. By no means is the black metal scene or black metal subculture monolithic in thought or ideology or spiritual viewpoint any more than the bands all sound exactly the same, because most of them, the more prominent acts, don't sound anything alike these days, you know, particularly when they've evolved album by album. Sure, there's different motifs that are kind of commonalities to that sound, but that's not unlike any other musical genre. And I guess what I'm trying to say here is, by no means is this a blanket support for everything that's ever been done in the name of the black metal scene or many of the beliefs that are held by certain more prominent black metal individuals, nor is this a blanket condemnation. I, as somebody who is intrigued in the search and the mystery and the various extremes that we as humans go to try to make sense of the world around us, the way that that search manifests itself in adversarial ways, in productive ways, in a sense of belonging, a sense of community, or a sense of dissatisfaction playing itself out, I'm fascinated by this stuff. And these are the types of conversations and things that I love searching through and discussing, particularly with rational and reasonable people like Satir. Now, don't get me wrong, this conversation is pretty focused on music, but we also talked quite a bit about Satir's upbringing in Norway and what it is about that place that's so unique and special and so integral to the art that it creates. About 2 years ago, in the fall of 2015, Satir was diagnosed with a brain tumor. The tumor was found to be benign and would apparently be more complicated to remove than to simply leave in there and monitor. In this conversation you're about to hear, Satir spoke candidly and honestly about living with the brain tumor and its impact on his outlook on life and art. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Satir Wongraven of Satyricon. This is No Prize from God.
Until my father wanted to get into farming. So when I was a couple of years old, he moved the family to a completely different part of the country, to the West Coast. And so then we were there for, I don't know, a couple of years or something. He rented a farm, and then he bought his own place, I guess, inland, middle of the country, one could say, where it's not really mountainous, but the forests are far and deep, so then we lived there until I was 10 years old, and it was during that time that I would become interested in hard rock and heavy metal music, because I had a couple of older cousins from up north, and I would see them during my holidays. That's what I always did, you know, whether it was summer or Christmas or Easter or whatever it was. I was up there, or they would come down, and, you know, they're a bit older than me. One of them is, 3.5 years older than me, and the other is 6 years older than me. So, you know, they were listening to Zeppelin and Sabbath. Not that much Sabbath, really. That was something that I kind of discovered through them, but they weren't huge fans. That was something I pursued on my own. But they were Zeppelin fans and Deep Purple to a large degree. And then there were other bands, Rainbow and Aussie solo stuff and Motorhead. And then when we lived on this farm in the middle of the country, then I ran into an older neighbor that introduced me to Kiss. So that was sort of the beginning of my, musical journey. You were asking about, life's bigger question. I mean, that was a turning point in my life. That became my life,
Yes. Yeah.
I would pass a lie detector test claiming that never dreamt of being, a firefighter or a policeman or any of that stuff. The only thing that I wanted to do was to be in a heavy metal band. That to me seems so much bigger than everything else. To me, that was my space travel,
Yeah.
It was like being an astronaut, and then firefighter, policeman would seem too ordinary, and it come like these things that completely lacked the larger than life aspect that I thought was so fascinating and attractive. And then at the age of 10, we moved to a peninsula outside of Oslo, and this is where I had the rest of my childhood and into my teens and early adult life. As soon as I came there already at the age of 10, again, an older kid down the street, and he introduced me to Metallica, Slayer, Anthrax, Testament, all of that, and it just went from there.
You were November 1975, and I'm November 1973. So I would imagine a lot of our touchstones, I mean, every band that you just mentioned, certainly, it sounds like we got into probably right around the same time and right around the same era for each of those bands. And what an amazing pivotal time, obviously, for the thrash metal movement in the mid 80s, but also, even when you mentioned Kiss, I remember getting into Kiss at the tail end of the makeup era. I had an older brother who was into Kiss, before that, during sort of the heyday. But for me, it was, the first record I heard was Creatures of the Night. And then not that long afterwards, they were out of the makeup. It's always interesting to me, all the different eras and identities that Kiss has had, where people encounter them and how the band can still have such an impact even in some of their sort of more obscure or bizarre eras of their lineup and so on.
What's interesting, at that age is that it doesn't really matter when stuff is from. For me, like with Kiss, I mean, I must have discovered Kiss through that neighbor farther up down, about a couple of kilometers from the farm. So we moved there in, what was it, like 79 or something. So I'm assuming he showed me this stuff around like 82 or something like that. And I don't have a slightest clue what it is that he was showing me. I don't remember, but I know that it wasn't until I was probably, I don't know, like 14 or 13 or 14, where I started relating to that this and that artist has a new record coming up, So for me, when I started listening to Maiden, whether Power Slave was b before or after Peace of Mind, I didn't know and I didn't care. It was either it's good or it's not good. So didn't matter where. So, but when I got a little older, the evolution of a band started mattering more. So like, after having listened to, let's say, Master of Puppets and Ride the Lightning for a couple of years, I started to get excited, like hearing from older kids that, Metallica has a new record coming up. So then you start following a band and like what's going on with the band, and I saw them play live and things like that. But at the early age, it was just about picking the cherries in, various bands' catalog, I guess.
And that's sort of the beauty of discovery, especially in that pivotal formative time when you're kind of, the genesis of your own, what will become your own musical identity. For me, I grew up in Indiana, which is, a pretty nowhere part of America, so-called flyover country. I'm curious whether the, farmlands of Norway, and then even, as you said, moving to Oslo, was there something about the theatricality and, like you said, the larger than life nature of heavy metal music specifically, and the imagery and the sound that sort of transported you out of an ordinariness that was in, a product of your daily life? Do you see some sort of connection there?
Yes, I do, but that's just that's the nature. like wherever you're at, there's always going to be something spectacular that, you know, makes you start imagining things like so. So, for example, you know, just using studios like, you know, recording studio services in Norway, it always felt, you know, as if it just wasn't the real deal. It was just Norwegian people in this small country trying to do, you know, what they've seen, heard about. And when it started coming to studios in America, in Los Angeles, I thought to myself, okay, so this is, you know, this is how it's really done. And so there's always something, you know, bigger and better out there that spurs you on to the next thing and motivates you to work a little bit harder so that, you know, so that maybe you can have access to that kind of stuff yourself at some point.
Certainly when it comes to black metal and Norwegian black metal in particular, you know, we have Satyricon, we have Dark Throne, we have Emperor, we have Enslaved, you know, bands who all grew to have very distinct identities apart from one another, and more than one of those bands, of course, that you were involved with directly and indirectly. What can you tell me sort of about the formative years of that scene and some of the ideas that were being exchanged even in conversation that made it become something that was so unique and so distinct that, you know, here in 2017 it's you know, it's practically part of the Norwegian tourist industry. You know, people go to Oslo and start, you know, looking for the sacred sites of early black metal.
Everything was a lot smaller, that's for sure. Less availability, fewer people listening to the music, fewer people playing it, fewer outlets in terms of, you know, there wasn't that many. I mean, so let's say, you know, you wanted to buy an extreme metal, like a black metal record. There were, you know, there were places who did sell it, but okay, so today there aren't, you know, there aren't that many retailers because the music industry has changed. But this was during the time where there was, you know, a record store on every corner. But just to find a black metal record was hard. So, you know, tape trading and fanzines and you know, helping each other out, spreading flyers through the mail, you know. If there was a t-shirt that, you know, you wanted a t-shirt from, let's say you were a big fan of this band and their second record, you probably have to, you know, try and get some people together and make 10 t-shirts with that band logo and that album cover for you and your nine other black metal.
Yeah.
Because no one made such a t-shirt. It was so unknown that I think that it was hard to define. I think when people saw us around, I'm not sure if they, you know, didn't really fit in. Definitely not bikers. Look weird compared to, you know, your typical Iron Maiden fan. Didn't fit into that punk rock style either. So I think it must have been confusing to a lot of people, like, you know, who are those guys? What is it about them? What do they listen to? What kind of style are they about? Because we did look different from the people who looked different.
Yeah, outcasts among the outcasts.
Yeah, exactly. And probably behave differently as well. So, and now everything is, you know, accessible and available. There's, you know, if you want to know something about a band, or it's all out there. But it was different back then, that's for sure. But I think the fact that it was small and there were a few really good bands was important in terms of musical growth. I don't think it would have been as strong if it wasn't for the fact that there was such transparency and competition that was positive. I don't think it was a type of competition that was necessarily friendly, but it wasn't hostile either. It was a type of competition where, like, being good in itself wasn't good enough. There would have to be something unique about you. Otherwise, you're not gonna get accepted. And I remember that was very important for me. I understood that very early, and I thought to myself that, you know, if we're gonna be a force to be reckoned with, then I have to try and not just make, you know, good music, but I'm gonna have to try and come up with something that is unique and helps define Satyricon, that is something that no one else is doing in this little scene. And I'm not sure that I would have felt compelled to do that and struggle to, or not struggle, but fought to achieve that if it wasn't for the transparency and that, you know, it was so small, so everyone knew what the other guy was doing, and you really had to push hard to be the best version of yourself.
Yeah, it's well said. I like that idea of the context of a highly creative and combustible environment where everyone's own creative spark is inspiring others around them to push that much harder to forge their own thing. That makes a lot of sense when you explain it that way.
Yeah.
One of the most fascinating things to me about Satyricon's journey artistically is the way that eventually the band sort of came back around almost to rediscovering the blueprint of the kind of, I would say, almost primitive hard rock elements that were still present in bands like Bathory and Venom that were, you know, also buried in this kind of atmosphere and darkness, but were still present. I always thought it was interesting that while Satyricon was one of the defining bands of the black metal era, that eventually the band evolved into something that was almost more straightforward while still retaining some of the elements of the ferocity and the passion that was inherent in black metal. You know, some of those touchstone bands that you think were there for you in the beginning that continued to be part of the blueprint and part of the DNA of what you're doing today. I mean, I would point to, I would think Bathory and Venom would be two of those. I'm sure there's more.
Well, I mean, the artistic bravery of Celtic Frost was always inspiring to me.
Yes.
So I always reiterated that I'm a kind of an artist that never really felt that inspired by other people's music, but rather the choices that they made. And I always felt that Celtic Frost, they were so good, but they were so brave too. I mean, they didn't, like, it wasn't like every record was reinventing the wheel. It was just that there was always progress. There were movies. It seemed like, okay, so if you listen to what's really what interesting is, I mean, are you well familiar with the band? Or?
Yeah, yes. And in fact, I would say that, you know, if it weren't for Into the Pandemonium, which nothing else sounded like at that time, we wouldn't have My Dying Bride, Anathema, Paradise Lost, a lot of incredible bands who did incredible things in their own right. Celtic Frost definitely paved the way for, as you said, bravery. I even remember one of my good friends at the time, who was, you know, one of my metalhead friends, that we were part of the small group that sat together in the cafeteria at school. We went to go buy Cold Lake the day it came out. And of course, that was like a shocking disappointment to so many fans.
Like, but being thrown into a cold lake, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And but it's interesting looking back now that we have the vantage point of history in the context of the whole Frost catalog. Now I see it as just another, while it's certainly not my favorite record, I see it as just another step in bravery, so to speak, for that band, where they were, you know, I mean, the type of decisions and choices, as you said, that a lot of bands won't take now for the sake of commerce or career or stability, whereas Celtic Frost just seemed like they were doing whatever, whenever, you know, wherever their muse sort of led them, even if it was even if it was into a very cold, cold lake.
Okay, so, I mean, my point was, if you listen to, the most famous song they ever did, Circle of the Tyrants, if you listen to the Emperor's Return version, which has that, you know, Morbid Tales kind of vibe to it, and then you compare it to Megatherium version, that's interesting because it's so transparent when it's not just the same band, but it's the same song. And then you see how they express the song in a really, really different way. And I don't like one more than the other. I just, they're just really different. And there's certain sections of the song which I find to be more interesting on the Emperor's Return version. And then there are other things that I find to be, have more depth on the on the slower, less energetic, but perhaps darker, more orchestrated version that they did. And that's something about the evolution of the band. So I think that looking at other bands' choices has been more inspiring to me than the music. And looking at Bathory, I think that, well, I mean, there's a comparing the first record to Blood, Fire, Death. There aren't that many years between them, but stylistically, we're talking light years. But that's okay. I mean, they're both really good records, but they have to be understood for what they are, and they're not really comparable, and that's why it doesn't make any sense to try and compare them. So I just say that it's the same band, only a few years apart, but very, very different, and but both good. And when I see stuff like that, I find that to be inspiring. So, and even when people have, listened to Satyricon records of the past and said black and roll, and even when they don't mean it in a bad way, they mean it in a good way, I think to myself that it's, even if it's with the best intention, it's a really stupid description, because then Venom is black and roll. Then half of A Blaze in the Northern Sky is black and roll, and a quarter of Dark Thrones Under a Funeral Moon is black and roll, and probably the entire first Bathory record and certain songs on everything they did on the next three would be black and roll. So it's just, it doesn't make sense to me that, like the need to try and like label something like that is, it's almost like, it's a form of insecurity, because it doesn't matter. It's is it good? Yeah, okay, fine. That's you don't have to, so sometimes, again, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I can talk to press who really don't mean it in a bad way, but they can say that, oh, I think your new record is blah blah blah, so and so. And I think it's just, it's a lot more than just your a black metal. To me, it transcends black metal. It's this and that and blah blah blah. And I say thank you, because I know it's meant as a compliment. But to me personally, it doesn't matter what it is. What matters to me is that it's fucking good.
Yeah.
I consider myself a black metal musician that play in a black metal band, and some things that I do are what you would, typically think of as black metal in the way that most people associate, and other things I do doesn't fit into that. But that doesn't make me more special. It doesn't make me less true. As I said, it doesn't matter.
It's interesting when you were talking about the creative leaps in a short amount of time in the Bathory catalog. I always point to the Beatles. They went from I Want to Hold Your Hand to Let It Be, within the span across the universe, within a span of like a decade. When you think about all the different eras of, one of the most definitive rock bands or pop bands or whatever you want to say of all time, how many different shades and colors there were.
They're one of the best bands ever. I'm a huge fan of the Beatles, and I agree with
It's interesting too when you were talking about the different versions of Circle of the Tyrants. I hadn't really thought about that before, and I think you're absolutely right. In fact, when we're done, I'm going to go back and listen to each of those versions again. I was just having this conversation the other day on a similar thought about the difference between Megadeth, Mechanics, and Metallica, the Four Horsemen. And obviously that's, you know, two different bands and the arrangements are different and so on. But yeah, just as you were saying, there are things that I like and appreciate about each of those versions that are distinct. You know, I think that the Megadeth version is faster and more aggressive and has a bit more energy to it. Whereas I think the Metallica version has significantly better lyrics. So it's, you know, it's always interesting where it's, I wouldn't even necessarily say that one's better or worse. It's interesting to hear the evolution of a piece of music like that from where it started, you know, listening to the No Life to Leather demo version and then hearing the finished versions by two different bands.
Yeah.
For you, because I know obviously this was different for different people in that sort of musical community at the time, where did the sort of, because I know obviously Satyricon's never been a political band or a religious band or any, you know, waving the banner for any specific ideology. I'm curious where the, you know, the idea of kind of exploring the heritage in Norway and resisting the, you know, what's been viewed as kind of an occupying force of Christianity and Christian thought and so on. Where did that first develop for you? And did you, were your parents religious people? Did you have people in your family or?
No religious people in my family. They go from a family of free-spirited people. You know, everyone's different. So my father is, you know, always been a really practical and really hardworking guy, and he doesn't talk about that stuff. And the few times in my life where he has mentioned anything like that, it's always fantastic because he will say stuff, you know, like once every decade. At the most, he'll say things like, I don't believe in any of that. When you're dead, you're dead. That's all there is to it. It's just, he thinks it's all nonsense. He's like, okay, you're born, you work hard, you die, the end.
Yeah,
he doesn't want to hear about it. And my mom is much more... spiritual, but in no way religious, you know, quite pragmatic, really. So I've never been in opposition to, you know, family members when it comes to any of this stuff. For me, it's just about, I find it offensive that, you know, well, so typically, the way it's been in history, truth is always in the hands of the victor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a nation, we're an old nation. And I find it to be interesting that when you talk about, you know, you see here, as people say that, well, it's important to, you know, protect our Christian heritage and our cultural heritage as a Christian nation. And that's who we are, and that's where we're from. And I think to myself, really? Really? So that'd be like, you know, that would be as if, let's say, Muslims would take over Norway, and then 2,000 years from now, they say, you know, we're a Muslim nation, and we need to protect and stand up for our cultural heritage as the Muslim nation we are, you know? Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be, you know, that would be false if that was the case. Just as, you know, the claim, even you have just like mainstream politicians saying that. And I think to myself, no, that's not right. I mean, that's not who we are. And that's not where we come from at all. That's actually just a really, really small part of our history. And, you know, 2,000 years of... Christianity in Western society, but not here. I mean, we can count, you know, about 1,000 years in Norway. So thinking about that, and I mean, so there's traces of heathen culture in Norway from what is it? Forgive me if I'm not 100% accurate, but something like 16,000 years BC, you know?
Yeah.
And then you talk about the, you know, the last 1,000 years as a Christian nation defines us as if that's who we've always been. And I've always felt the need to, you know, speak up against that and influence people not to buy crap like that through my music and my role as an artist. But so that's how I see.
One of the things I always respond to personally in art is, or I shouldn't say always, I mean, you know, exclusively respond to an art as a point of view. And when I say that, sometimes that's mistaken for, you know, oh, I want a strong political point of view or this or that. And no, what I mean by that is an artistic point of view where you have something meaningful to say that's authentic and truthful to you and that you're passionate about putting forward. And that can be, you know, that can just as easily be a song about a broken relationship or a longing for, you know, nostalgia about some other time and place or whatever it is. You know, that's what I respond to. And that's one of the things that's made me a fan of your work for a long time is feeling that kind of transcendent force of nature of that you have something to say with your art and that you're truthful about making that for its own sake. Would you say that, you know, I mean, you mentioned your conversations with your father, which I find interesting because I've had different conversations with my own father and sort of watched him change and evolve with this stuff over time. And we had in fact, the most recent conversation we had just about a week ago, we were talking about the show The Sopranos and about the famous ending of that show. And I was talking about, from an artistic point of view, all the different clues and theories and things that have been put together that sort of point to, and not to spoil the show if you've never seen it, but it's been 10 years. The idea that, you know, when death happens, it's just complete silence, complete blackness. That's just, you know, that's the end. And I was just talking about that in terms of the show and the story that the show was telling. And my dad, who I was actually talking to him on his birthday, he just turned 78. He says, yeah, you know, that probably is what happens. It was just kind of one of those, you know, you're taken aback for a second. Like, I have a same kind of relationship with my dad where it's just not something that comes up often throughout my life. And yeah, for him to say that to me on his 78th birthday, and then I'm kind of going, how did I walk us into this conversation? Like, I want to walk right back out of it. I'm curious, do you feel any kind of connection to, you know, whether it's sort of the Germanic heathenism and Norse paganism and that sort of thing, or do you have kind of a compass for that sort of stuff, or are you also very more sort of pragmatic where it's just like, this is...
I feel a very strong connection with my country and my people and the nature and everything. You know, I think what I like about this country is... that it does feel really, really unique. You know, there are many things about it that has to improve, but that has more to do with us as a nation. But in terms of, I think most Norwegians experience, if they've been traveling abroad for a long time, is that one of the probably most appealing things about coming back home to Norway is the crisp air. There's just nothing like it, and it feels in many ways so much more pure and untouched compared to what I would consider comparable places. And you know, as a person whose job is to travel across the world, I find it so strange that there are so many places out there that where you probably shouldn't drink the tap water, and if you do, it's going to taste horrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you buy a bottle of water here, you might as well just flush your money down the toilet.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? Water quality here is excellent, you know. And
and why would you buy water in Norway when you can buy Wongraven wines?
There you go. So for me, it's a lot of the strong belonging that I feel is about the unique nature that I am a part of, and that, you know, we are really a people who who like to get out, and I think that's a good thing. And it's interesting as a Norwegian feeling this strong connection to nature and how it represents who we are and where we're from, and that you feel united with previous generations through our nature. It's funny, having traveled all around the US touring, I've been to almost all the states. I mean, I haven't been to Alaska, I haven't been to Hawaii. I'm not sure if I've been to Rhode Island and Maine and places like that, but that's pretty much it. The rest, I've been there, and most of them several times. Indiana too.
Yes.
And it's interesting because many of the places that have something about them actually to some degree resemble Norway are places where I never hear people talking about that. When I, like, for example, traveling through places like Wyoming, a lot of the nature there that actually really reminds me of Norway. It has, but I don't hear a lot of Americans talking about places like that. And then I ask myself, is it because, they can only go so many places and they rather see Manhattan, or is it because they're not aware, or because they, want to pursue different things in life? But I don't know, like, I hope to be able to one day explore nature in the states more, because there are certain states in America that, at least judging from, looking out the lounge window of a tour bus, just have spectacular nature that I would really like to, go trekking in and become a part of.
That's incredible. And that's a whole I'll email you some ideas at some point. A lot to say there. I wanted to ask you lastly that feel free to tell me it's none of my business and we can edit it out. You had mentioned, on your Instagram account, I think a couple of years ago, that you'd been diagnosed with the brain tumor, and I was just curious if there was an update on your health in that regard and if things are the same or better or worse or.
Sure. Well, for the most part, I'm doing quite well. It was never, anything life-threatening in the way that it's benign. So, in theory, its presence could kill me, but that's just highly unlikely. A lot of things would really have to go wrong at the same time. And like, when you know what's there, and if you start getting, a lot of, so if I was to get a lot of heavy symptoms, I wouldn't be guessing. I know what it is, and I know what I need to do, and I know, where I need to go. And I'm being monitored, so that's not gonna happen. So for me, it's more, it's been like this. First you discover it and you go, oh no, like, why? And you start thinking, I haven't enough stuff in my life and to deal with something like grave like this is the least thing you want. And then quickly, at least I started thinking, like, okay, well, so it is what it is. What are we going to do about this? And I started thinking in a very practical sense. I started thinking, well, okay, I know a lot of people, so I need to take advantage of all my contacts and just trying to get the best possible help out there. I'm a resourceful person. I should use that to my advantage now more than anything that I've ever done, because nothing's more important than this. Just kept saying to myself that every time someone says, you can't do that, get in line, then I'm not going to do what they tell me. And no matter how awkward it makes me feel and makes then feel I'm going to have to stick up for myself, because at the end of the day, I can't expect anyone else to fight that fight for me. So that was my attitude and my mental approach from day one. And then, like anyone else in a similar situation, just gathering information and try to become an expert yourself. And then I've kind of gone from there, and I've learned to how to adjust, because most of the time, there's nothing out of the ordinary with me. But from time to time, I'll have rather extreme headaches, or I'll be nauseous, dizzy, sometimes some issues with my vision and or shaking of my hand, things like that. But that's normal. Like, that's not something. So my neurosurgeon was kind of like, yeah, so that's textbook.
And that, and that's comforting when you hear that, when they're like, oh yeah, I know what that is. That's no big deal. We, yeah.
It would be really different if he said, oh really?
Could you tell me more about that? This is the first I've heard of this.
Exactly. No, so I felt actually really relieved when I met, the neurosurgeon in Norway that has dealt with this the most. And he just, all right, yeah, so this is what it's like when, in your situation. And he said, forget about that other hospital. You should just come see me, and we'll look after you. And that's what they do. And then most of the time, life's pretty normal. I think the only thing that really I find to be hard is that it's a kind of a state where you never really know when your day is gonna turn bad. So that kind of sucks. Like, if you get up in the morning and you haven't, I've felt good for a month, and then all of a sudden, like 3 or 4 hours into the day, start to feel terrible, and you think to yourself, so what's going to happen now? Is this going to go away in a couple of hours, or should I call someone? Or and to be honest with you, the only thing that I find to be difficult is this uncertainty of not knowing whether lightning will strike from a blue sky. That's the shit that can cross your mind, like when you're out driving on a highway, for example.
Yeah, and that's what I was gonna say actually, is to a large degree, we all, you have kind of that metaphorical cartoon anvil hanging over your head in terms of this condition, but at the same time, we all do, just with mortality in general. You have a physical reminder of it inside your head, but we all have a intangible reminder in our head. We just try to ignore it all day.
That's true. So that's really where I'm at. I just try and focus on my daily tasks and do that well, and that serves me well. And then I just have to make adjustments. I feel much more bad for those people who, walk around with something terminal. And I had, at the same time as I, probably just 3 weeks before I was hospitalized the first time, a good acquaintance of mine and a good colleague, musician, he was diagnosed with some form of stomach cancer. And I felt that what he was going through was a lot worse, because I think to myself, like, all the stuff that he had to do. I mean, he's fine and he's cancer free, but first of all, it was malignant. He had to do surgery. It kind of screwed up his whole system, and he fucking had to walk around for weeks with diapers because they, fucked up his whole system. And how undignified is that for a grown-up man to be able to do that? And even when he told me that I'm doing fine, just by looking at him, I could tell that, he did not look fit and strong. And so just like, the word brain tumor in itself is terrifying, but it doesn't have to be that brutal. And nowadays you hear about, malignant cancers, tumors, and you hear about all these people who survive, and they just continue with their lives. But having, known a couple of guys that have gone through that and are doing well, just seeing them going through that, it looks horrible. It really, like the treatment they have to go through, it really breaks people down. So in my book, I'd rather deal with what I'm dealing with than what they've been through, to be honest with you.
And does that, obviously those of us who are into heavier music and I would say into art in general, but certainly we deal with these meditations on life and death all the time. Did you find, especially in the beginning, did this have you thinking about your mortality a little more? And do you have opinions or ideas about what, if there's anything beyond what we see and feel in this life, or is this it and make the most of it?
Well, what's been important to me is to do the things that I feel that I have to do. I mean, I always considered myself a person that could not afford visual arts, so I always felt that my interest and love for visual arts was expressed through my visits to museums and galleries and through buying art books and magazines, and that was all there was to it. And as I came out of my first hospital stay, and I was lying in bed home all the time, and I thought to myself, so what's all this work for? I mean, all the with my work ethics and the drive that I have, and the persistence that I show in my energy and my effort, like what is it all for? Like paying the electricity bill? I mean, and I thought, oh, this is bullshit. And then I decided right there and then that I'm gonna start buying art. I felt as if that was something that I had to do because it's not right that all of the money that I make should go to paying for all these practical things. It's just I almost felt like a form of injustice, actually. And then I thought to myself, well, I'm not going to be able to, buy a ton of things, but then I started looking into especially prints. So I did buy a few originals as well, but a lot of prints, that was very important to me, and that has helped. That it's well, I feel inspired by being surrounded by visual arts.
That's powerful. I just it's funny for different, arrived at the a similar conclusion through different means, but yeah, I started buying art for the first time myself a few years ago and had that same I had a friend actually who explained to me, well, you can buy prints. And yeah, same thing. I have like two originals of things I like, and then yeah, I have a prints all around the house now. And yeah, and it is exactly as you said, it's inspiring to anything creative that you sit down to do to have that stuff around you.
Yeah,
I love it. So new Satyricon record comes out September 22nd. What is the next few months look like for you, and when and where can people come and see you?
So up until that point, it's all about preparing for September 22nd, and gonna start off with doing a rooftop gig in Oslo on top of a high riser, so kind of similar to the Beatles.
I was just about to say, speaking of the Beatles, when we were talking about the end period of the Beatles, that was exactly what I was picturing, was them on the roof. So here we are, full circle.
So we're gonna do that. That will be our release party, and that's gonna be invited guests and competition winners. And then day after, we head to Hamburg in the north of Germany to start our Euro tour, continuing to Latin America, and the region tour. Then after Christmas and New Year, it's gonna be Russia, Greece, and the band's first trip to Israel, and there's going to be another European tour in the spring of next year, and then if everything goes well with visas and work permit, our first visit to the US in, well, it'll be 9 years then, in May, June next year.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this today. I appreciate your candidness and straightforwardness, and taking some time out of what is obviously a very busy day and series of days to have this conversation.
Thank you. All right. I wish you the best with your podcast.
That does it for this episode of No Prize from God. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what we're doing here, please rate and review the podcast. Give us one of those 5-star ratings and say something nice in the iTunes store. And the reason why I'm asking you to do that is because the more ratings and positive reviews we get, the higher the visibility and the more people that can discover this show. Check out some of the past episodes with incredible guests like Matty Mullins from Memphis Mayfire, Jesse Leach from Killswitch Engage, Tim McTagg from Under Oath, Episcopal priest and theologian Broderick Greer, and my old friend, Dwid Hellion of the band Integrity. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey, on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. You can find No Prize from God on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. No Prize from God is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. You guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.